Good morning and welcome to this March 4th, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on Stitcher. Once we get our iTunes link fixed, I think we've identified the problem finally. We will shortly be back up there under Writers on Writing. And we're on Facebook, obviously, Writers on Writing. Barbara's website is penonfire.com. My website is mariestone.com. You can write to us with your thoughts. You can find out more about the show, about our past guests, about our upcoming guests. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I am doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. I'm breaking my own little personal record this morning. Never have I had one guest on four times, but today I'm happy to welcome Colm McCann back on for the fourth time. Colm is the internationally best-selling author of the novels Transatlantic, Let the Great World Spin, Zoli, Dancer, This Side of Brightness, and Song Dogs, as well as three critically acclaimed short story collections and the nonfiction book Letters to a Young Writer. His fiction has been published in over 40 languages. He's the recipient of the National Book Award, a Guggenheim, the Pushcart Prize, and an Oscar nomination for his short film Everything in This Country Must. He teaches in the Hunter College MFA program. He's also the co-founder of Narrative 4, which we'll hopefully talk about. McCann's latest, A Paragon, is inspired by the real-life relationship between the Palestinian Bassam Armin and Israeli Rami Elhanan, both whom lost young daughters in the Middle East conflict. Part nonfiction, part imagination, the book weaves history and ornithology and music and art and mathematics and nature and politics to bring depth and complexity to these characters' lives. It's told in 1,001 sections as an homage to the Arabian Nights, 1,001 Nights. It might be his most ambitious novel yet. It's published by Random House, and it will drive our discussion this morning. Colm, welcome back.
I'm so delighted to be back and honored to be on a fourth time.
I was going to say, you're probably getting sick of me, so I really appreciate you doing this.
Not at all.
And it's funny because though we've talked three times before, we haven't talked since 2015, which I just feel like was another world ago. So, you know, now we're here sort of mid-apocalypse and...
Wow.
And it's, yeah. You know, everything is, I was going to say everything old is new again, but I guess everything's just new again. But
I can't, that's 5 years. Yeah. That's what, actually when I first started working on this novel. So,
and I think, you know, I think there was some sort of reference to it the last time we talked that you, you'd found this story and you were going to dive into it. So, you know, the fun thing about having somebody on so many times, because I often talk to writers, somewhere along in the mid of their career about the commonalities across their work. And now, you know, with you being on, I can see it for myself because I've been with your work for so long. But, you know, this book is so utterly unique and new, and yet you can just see your fingerprints all over it of, you know, drawing inspiration from real life people and sort of the kaleidoscopic nature of your storytelling. So it's really fun. As you do that, as you sort of go through that exercise of looking across everything you've written, do you kind of feel the same way that you can see yourself across all of it, even though they're all very different works?
You know, every time I finish a book, I'm pretty sure that I'll never be able to write another book. You know, I sort of feel exhausted and I look back on the books I've written before and say, how did I get away with it? How did I somehow, you know, pull the wool over my own eyes. And I know I'm never going to be able to do it again. And then slowly you start to read again. Slowly you start to, like, you know, get curious about things. And then suddenly you get obsessed by something new. But I have to say with this book, it has felt like a culmination. Because it's a big book and it contains a lot of, as you say, it contains a lot of my other books. There are references to Philippe Petit, who I wrote about in Let the Great World Spin. There are references to George Mitchell, whom I wrote about in Transatlantic. There are references to Sandhogs, whom I wrote about when I wrote a book a long time ago in the subway tunnels of New York called This Side of Brightness, and Sandhog being a tunnel digger. And so there's a lot of material in this book that's taken from, well, wow, it's hard to believe, but it's a 30-year
How does that happen? Right.
Right. Years just go by like that. It's just it doesn't seem right.
Yeah, right. Right. So this, you know, I mean, I appreciated so much about this, but I've always had this sort of mental difficulty penetrating the Middle Eastern conflict. And I'm, you know, I'm not a history buff and I'm not a politics buff. And I'm not a religious buff, but I feel like, you know, there are certain things living in the world as a curious person that you should wrap your head around. And so I try, and this book kind of feels like the first time. I still don't really understand it, but at least now I really feel it. And, you know, I had such empathy for obviously for these characters. And I'd love for you to just kind of take us into that, you know, the last time we spoke to how you met these two men and kind of how their story unfolded and how you knew this was going to be the next book.
Right. Well, that's a profoundly generous thing for you to say. And I have to acknowledge straight up that I was confused too. Completely bamboozled by this whole notion of what was going on over there, trying to figure it out from all sorts of different angles, and and I'm still confused. And part of the I was going to say trick of the book, but part of the ethos of the book, in fact, is to surrender to that confusion. I sort of ask the reader to, this is going to be confusing. Trust me, the confusion will go away, because what we need to do is admit to the fact that we're confused. Stop trying so hard to get it all right. Stop trying to, you know, arrest ourselves on certain principles and areas, and admit that it's neither red nor blue in an American context. It's purple, you know, mm-hmm. And we're in that area of confusion, which is okay. And once we say it's okay to be confused, then we can get to a deeper emotional core, which is what I was trying to do. So once we say, you know, forget about area A, C, B, C, that all matters. Yes, it matters. But let's get down to the core of these stories of these two men and their two daughters, and when you begin to understand it on that emotional level, your understanding will increase exponentially. It'll sort of spiral upwards. So I wanted to write a book for everybody who knew nothing at all about Israel-Palestine, and at the same time, for those who knew everything about it at the same time. So to try to get it all correct. And to acknowledge the confusion. So what happened was, I went over there. I went on a trip with Telos, T-E-L-O-S. It's a non-profit organization that brings community peacemakers together. And I traveled around with a group of activists and artists and musicians. And then on the second to last night of the first two-week trip, went into this little room in an office building in Beit Jala, which is just outside Jerusalem, right next door to Bethlehem, walked up the steps. It was dark afternoon, November afternoon. It was cold, sort of damp, and into this little office that smelled of coffee and cigarettes, and guided to this back room where two men were sitting. And they introduced themselves. One was named Rami, the other one was named Bassam. And I sat down, and I thought, you know, I've met lots of interesting people the last couple of weeks, all around Israel, all around Palestine, and these look like ordinary blokes. And so I sat down to listen to them, and my heart was blown open inside less than half an hour. When they began to tell their stories about how they had lost their 13-year-old daughter and 10-year-old daughter to conflict. One is Israeli, the other one is Palestinian. They became the best of friends because they believe that they can harness the power of their grief in order to shift people and to give people understanding about what's going on in the Middle East. And their main thesis is so simple that it's like it's shockingly difficult. We need to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And in Israel and Palestine, it's really difficult. In ways that unless you go there, it's hard to understand. There are walls, there are physical walls, but there are mental walls, there are psychological walls, there are spiritual walls, there are all sorts of things. And what these men say is, let's take down these walls. It's time. We need to do this, because if we don't do it, we will not know each other above ground, but guess what? We definitely will know each other below ground, because we'll be 6 feet under together. And so they have this extraordinary message. I got to write a novel about them, and I wanted the form of the novel to mess with the reader's head, quite frankly, to be a bit of a head wrecker and a bit of a heart wrecker as well at the same time. It was a long chore for me, but I got to know these men very, very well. Did numerous journeys back and forth to the West Bank and to Israel, and they became the best of friends. And now they're traveling with me, and we're going around the country together, sort of promoting this book with the funkiest title ever.
I love the title.
A Paragon, which is a shape with a countably infinite number of sides.
I learned so much. I mean, that was part of the reason that it took me so long. It took me forever to read this. And, you know, with every section, I was like, is that true? Is there really a wire around New York that, you know, and does this math problem really work out? And is this really, you know, did Philippe Petit do this crazy walk with this crazy bird? I mean, there's so many things in there that stopped me in my tracks that I was like, I have to look that up. I have to watch this. And, yeah, it was a real education. When you, you know, in the past, you've written a lot about real life, larger than life, Philippe Petit being one, Dancer, you did this. But these are two just real, raw civilian men. And I wondered if taking on the story of non-famous people, I mean, now they're out in the public eye, of course, but really, you know, kind of more private individuals as opposed to public figures, using their stories to jump off from, if there was a difference between those two things for you.
Yes. It's more terrifying talking about sort of ordinary, quote unquote, unknown, quote unquote, people. Because, you know, I wrote about Rudolf Nureyev and frankly, you know, the Russian dancer. And frankly, Rudolf Nureyev, even if he has passed away, or his people or his reputation is able to take care of itself. It precedes him. Nothing that I'm going to write is necessarily going to dent him. You know, when I wrote about George Mitchell, you know, I went to Mitchell, and you know, a lot of the things were, you know, Senator George Mitchell were in the public eye. When I wrote about Philippe Petit, it was rather similar. But I do have responsibility to my characters, no matter whether they're, quote, real or unreal. But with these guys, Rami and Bassam, I really, really, really wanted to get it correct, because they are, you know, they're sort of extraordinary, and you know, they could. If I wanted to make sure I got the real texture, the human texture of the story, because it's really quite an incredible thing. It's hard for us, you know, in the States to understand that it's radical for a Palestinian man to sit on stage with an Israeli man or woman and to talk about brotherhood, friendship, occupation, all of these sort of things. It takes a lot of gumption, a lot of chutzpah, if you will, to do so on both sides. They've taught me an enormous amount, mostly about like decency and humility and drive, because they know that what they have to do is tell the story and get people on board, and maybe even create a movement underneath where we start to look at one another. We start to like, this is about Israel-Palestine, sure, but guess what? It's also about, like, California, you know, Northern California, Southern California, border communities and non-border communities. It's also about like the South Bronx and Kentucky or whatever, you know, these places where we are all so seemingly different, but in the end, we're actually really not all that different. And when we acknowledge that, I love the fact that we're different.
Yeah.
Hallelujah. I don't want to be like anyone else, but I don't want to hate somebody else because of these apparent differences.
Right.
And, you know, that's what's going on. We all know that's what's going on in the politics of our country. And so these men, yes, they're talking about Israel and Palestine, but I also think they're just talking about, you know, you and me and where we all were this morning or last night. And that's why it was a privilege to get a chance to take a whack at their stories.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody last week about this. She had this theory that every writer, I guess every one of us, but every writer has this kind of magnet board in our chest that we pull things into. And your magnet board is so obvious to me as a reader, and maybe obvious to you as a writer. But I also think that the times...
It's not. I wish it was, but no, it's not. I don't... Yeah. I never know quite what it is that like you write towards your obsessions, and sometimes you just, you know, you get hit, as you say, in the chest. It's beautiful, like analogies, but you try to deal with this heart thump that's going on, and the only way to do it is to negotiate it. If you're a writer, is to negotiate it through writing, or if you're a reader, to negotiate it through reading, that's what makes the world go round, I think.
Yeah. And I also, but I'm also curious if it's the time that the stories hit you, because if you would have encountered this exact same story 20 years ago when you were younger, or when our country was in a totally different place, you know, you almost wonder if it would have hit you in the same way. But if you know our politics have something to do with this being particularly resonant for all of us to pick up, as you say, it's
Yeah, there is that tuning fork in the chest, right? It's picking up on things. One hopes as a writer that your tuning fork is a couple of years in advance, and somehow you're intuiting what's about to come. Because I started this like 5 years ago, I could see even at that stage that there were these gulfs in our own communities. Because I had started along with Lisa Consiglio, a non-profit organization called Narrative 4, where we bring people from different backgrounds together, mostly young people, mostly teenagers, to share stories with one another. And in fact, some of those communities include, say, a high school in the South Bronx and a high school in Kentucky, where the kids, at first, are totally scared of one another because of, you know, whatever available stereotypes are in place, whatever cliches are there. You know, you're white and I'm black, and you're rural and I'm urban, and you know, you fly a Confederate flag, and you think that I'm going to call you a racist, or whatever. You know, all these different things. Mm-hmm. And once they get together and look one another in the eye and tell one another stories, it's so much more nuanced than all of that. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about like some kumbaya, pie in the sky sort of. Aren't all the violins about to break out all at once moment? No, and that doesn't interest me whatsoever, because stories are dangerous as well. You know, stories can take your house away, your reputation away, and all these things. But I also think that stories are one of our most profound and available, personification of the democratic system. And so I think, as a writer, you would hope that you're tapping into currents that are there in the culture, and that you're speaking to them, and that you'd be humble enough to acknowledge that these are not your thing, but they belong to the wider world.
Right. You know? Right. Right. One thing that occurs to me as we're having all of these conversations at least in the literary community, probably in the bigger community, about appropriation of other people's stories, the thing that occurred to me over and over about this book is it would be almost impossible for an insider to write. As you say, you know, it's such a radical act for a Palestinian to sit on the stage with an Israeli. It would be almost impossible for somebody inside to write this story that bridges both their stories. And and you're so uniquely positioned, having come from Northern Ireland and your experience there. And I'd just love for you to speak for a minute about sort of your philosophies on this appropriation topic and your approach to this book.
No, it's incredibly important. And hallelujah to all the people who are bringing up this notion of cultural appropriation in our universities and wherever else, because they're so right. Cultural appropriation is so real and so dangerous, because we do go in, we do patronize, and we do steal and we mock and we take advantage and we don't think, and we don't stretch, and we don't sometimes see past our own noses, and this is quite patently wrong. If your intention is to go in to take away from another culture, then it's wrong, plain and simple, and we have to be called out on it. And so I think this is a really sound, powerful debate. And on the same hand, not the other hand, because it's not the other hand, on the same, exact same hand, in the same well, in the same palm of the hand, let's talk also about cultural celebration, where we go in as writers, thinkers, readers, to learn, to share, to deepen, to, where you go in with a bit of humility and a grace, and you go in saying, hey, I'm confused, can you teach me? And, and maybe even get a little bit kicked around by the truth, to talk about history, to talk about colonialism, to talk about all that that patronizing sense that has happened to other people. Celebration as opposed to appropriation, that's an extraordinary place for us to be. It seems to me that cultural appropriation is colonial by nature, but cultural celebration is sort of communal by nature. So I think, for myself, people can say that, I'm going in but as you say, there is no insider could have done inside Israel and also be inside Palestine at the exact same time. And I felt like I was in a pretty unique position. I didn't have any skin in the game. I'm not Israeli. I'm not Palestinian. I am interested in peace and peace process. I am interested in telling it sort of, a very human story. But I'm also an activist, and I believed in the power of what these people were saying. And I knew I was going to get some four-letter words thrown at me, and they have been thrown at me already, Mary. You've got to stand up there and do some sort of some sort of weird Aikido to knock them off, because I believe in this story, and I believe in these men, and I believe in their daughters, I believe in the power of their message. Is that me being on a high horse? Well, fair enough, that's okay. I hope I'm not on a high horse. I don't tell anybody how to feel in this book, but I think, or at least I hope, I say this with all humility, that this allows people to feel the story of Abir and Smadar. And like I said, Abir was 10 years old and Smadar was 13, just about 14. One went out, was buying candy, the other one was out shopping for school books. They both ended up dead. This story happens, yes, in Israel, Palestine, yes, in Belfast, yes, in Colombia, yes, sort of all over the place. As well as being a specific story, it's also, I hope, a universal story.
With the nature of the criticism that you've received so far has been what? I mean, people are taking issue with you telling the story at all. People are taking issue with you, trying to establish peace, or what's the problem?
Yeah, no, there's a couple of outliers. I mean, there's always going to be a couple of outliers. I've been on the road now for about a week, and it's extraordinary the people who are coming up and wanting to talk. And half of that week I've been on the road with Rami and Bassam themselves, and you should see the outpouring of love for them. So I would really hesitate to say, you know, that like a couple of slings and arrows aimed in my direction deserve any attention at all. Because the matter is, this is really important. We're in a big moment now, where people have to stand up and say, you know, there are edges, and those edges deserve to be heard. But there are also there are things in the middle. I'm not saying I necessarily dwell in the middle, but as I said, things are a lot more purple than they are red or blue. We're not as stupid as our political parties seem to want us to be, or our corporations seem to want us to be. We shouldn't be so easily boxed off. And I love this old American notion, that sort of Whitman-esque in its origin, that, you know, I am large, I contain multitudes. Because guess what? I think even within our own bodies and our own heads, we contain multitudes. And it's okay to be confused. It's okay to be scattered. It's okay to not know what's going on. But it's not okay not to feel or think about others on the other side. Is it okay to take criticism? Sure, you know, I got a good kick in the arse from somebody in the New York Times. The New York Times had two reviews. One was spectacular. The other one was, let's just say, less than spectacular. That's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah. It doesn't bother me. Listen, if you believe the good stuff, you must, by necessity, by natural corollary, you must believe the bad stuff, and you just have to know yourself what it is. I put my heart and soul into this book. I know it. I know what it is, because it's a book for Rami and Bassam, and this radical notion that they have that we should actually know each other. Wow, you know.
I love it. My guest this morning is Colin McCann. The book is A Paragon. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So we have to dive into just sort of how you did this, because it's unlike anything else I've read. I've seen things written in fragments, not like this. And there are a couple of words I feel like should be invented as I think you've invented a couple of literary devices that I searched and searched and couldn't find language for. Maybe you have the language for it, but it's told in 1,001 parts, and maybe we start there. Maybe you talk about that initial decision to tell it that way, and then we can kind of dive into how you did it.
Well, this book, it's new for me. Honestly, and you probably hear this from writers all the time, writers are not necessarily as smart as people think they are. You know, and especially the smart writers are not necessarily as smart, you know what I mean? The more you know, the more you realize how little you know. And often you're going on a wing and a prayer. I embarked on this novel on a wing and a prayer and a gut instinct. And all I wanted to do was get it right, somehow get it right. What am I doing? What in the world am I doing? Okay, so it's coming in fragments. Shall it be 100 fragments? Shall it be 365 fragments? No. Okay, then eventually settle on the idea that it would be 1,001, which is an enormous amount to carry. But I felt like I was writing a symphony, and I don't know anything about music. My problem in life is that I do sing, but I can't. But the analogy was always there. I felt like I was sitting in the office that I'm sitting in right now talking to you, and I was like waving a baton trying to get the contrabass over there to go, and the violin to come in now, and the piano to come in here. And at the same time, kicking down the doors at the back of the at the back of the hall, and a big blinding light comes through, and a number of other musicians are pouring in, carrying these instruments the size of which and the like of which I've never, ever, ever heard before. And I'm getting them to go, okay, sit down over there and start playing. And I want you to be part of this eventual music. And it was about point and counterpoint. It was about rhythm and style. And it was getting the music to express as powerfully as it can the most deeply human thing, which is about grief, loss, and guess what? Hope. Because I know this book sounds like it's, you know, it's a downer, and it certainly was a difficult one to do. But in the very end, in the deep, deep, deep end, it's really a book about, you know, proper forms of hope and engagement and knowing one another. So it was, quite a journey for me, and really, I wish I could tell you, yes, I'm smart, and I knew right away it was going to be 1,001 parts, and you know, pat myself on the back, and it was going to be ascending and then descending numbers, and but most of that was found while I was shuffling through, and I think like your listeners should think of it as like, you know. It's like a musician going into the studio. Like Van Morrison went into the studio to make an album called Astral Weeks 50 years ago. It took him a long time to get it, but he got it, and he got it right by, you know, practicing, editing, you know, move and listening to whatever great guide or whatever great angels he happened to be listening to at that stage, and then ended up making an album that goes down in history as one of the great albums. Writers are like that. Mm-hmm. We're like musicians, and in fact, I kind of wish I was a musician, to be honest with you.
I used to have this professor years ago who, Mary Rakow, who wrote this great book, The Memory Room, and she wrote it kind of similarly with these fragments, and she physically color coded them. So she had them spread all over her house, and then she would assign a color to an emotion, and then she could kind of physically see, okay, I've got too much anger. Now it's time for a little bit of levity, or, you know, I need some humor. And as you're talking about this notion of symphony, that's kind of how it strikes me. Like, we got too much tambourine, we need a little more saxophone, and you know, if you can either see it or hear it or something to get the balance right, that's a really interesting way to think about structuring.
Well, you know, I'm kind of weird. Like, I'm the messiest person. Like, I look around this office right now, and it's a disgusting mess. It's like, I got hats, I got coats, I got books, I got bags, I got, like, you know, plates, and, you know, water bottles, and you know, all sorts of things, photos all over the place. So my life is a scattered mess. But when it comes to my fiction, for whatever reason, I'm able to hold all that stuff in my head. So I didn't have note cards. I didn't have anything like that. What I would do pretty regularly is go into my college, Hunter College in New York, where I teach in the creative writing program, the MFA. And I would go down to the photocopy shop, and I would print the stuff out, and I'd try and make it look like a book. You know, I'd justify it left, justify it right, you know, do two pages opposite each other, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
To see how it felt as a book, as I went through. And, you know, honestly, like, if readers get a chance to read it, they should be prepared for a fairly difficult encounter, because it does sort of, like, it goes from one to the next, but my readers are the ones who are much more agile than I am. And in the end, I'm going to learn from them, you know, going out on the road, talking to them and so on. And they're the brave ones. They're the ones who sort of take this on and then make something new of it. It's not my book anymore, you know?
Yeah, right. So you're not writing in your closet anymore. Used to. Last time we talked, you were in your closet, I think.
My closet's still here. I talked with a guy last night, in fact, who is going to come in and like rip out the closet, because I was sitting with my legs outstretched and my, you know, in this cupboard basically, sometimes for hours and hours and hours a day, and I wrecked my hamstrings.
Oh.
Yeah, and I'd like they got so tight that I was having you know, back problems and all that sort of stuff, and so I'm no longer in the closet. I'm out of the closet.
You're out of the closet. Okay.
And ready to do something sort of entirely new.
Interesting. So is there a word? So there's the only word I can think of is device to call it. Throughout the book, where you will take, for example, there's this wire that I didn't know about that surrounds Manhattan that delineates the Orthodox. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. And so there's this wire, and then the next section you will jump to Philippe Petit crossing this wire, and you use this device throughout the book in a ton of different ways. But this bridging of one idea to the next idea. Somebody will be mowing a lawn, and then the Israelis will get mowed down, or you know, the Palestinians will get mowed down.
Exactly.
Is there a word for that, or is that?
I'm sure there is. I'm sure someone much smarter than me is out there saying, "Yes, say that word."
But yeah, I can't find that word.
I mean, it's association, disassociation. It's hopscotching in a way, but also I think. And what it's trying to do is to create a map of the contemporary mind. Because guess what? I really don't think that we would have been able to deal with a novel like this 50 years ago. We just didn't think in those ways. But due to our phones, due to our computers, due to our habits, due to the bombardment of things that we get all the time, we have sort of learned to adjust to this notion of like hopping and moving from one place to the next. And my job was to do that, create a map of the human mind in relation to where we are now, and always come back to the girls.
Mm-hmm.
Always come back to the girls to say this is important. And guess what? We are complicit. We are involved. We are in Jerusalem. You know, this is the meeting place of like three, you know, continents. It's also the birthplace of at least three, you know, major, spiritual movements. You know, we're talking about Christianity, we're talking about Islam, we're talking about Judaism, and then there are other things. And so much of the world's energy is, you know, emanating from that particular area. So much of the world's hatred also emanating from that area, but also so much of the beauty that could be possible is coming from that area. And I wanted to try to locate that and say it also happens in Dublin. It also happens, you know, in San Diego. It also happens in, you know, Siberia. And, you know, once we realize that we're all involved in this, then maybe somebody will come along and do the miraculous. Because guess what, Mary? I mean, the miraculous happens. You know,
yeah.
The Berlin Wall fell at one stage.
Yeah.
Ireland, after 800 years, has a peace process that has now lasted 22 years.
Yeah.
There are things that go on that come out of nowhere, like Arab Springs and things like that, that can turn things around, but there are also things that can turn things evil.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to be alert to the potential for all of this to happen in various ways. And how do we get aware of evil, and how do we get aware of good? We listen to people who know what's going on. And Rami and Bassam, they happen to be two men who know what's going on. And they're heartbroken. They lost their girls. They didn't want to lose their daughters. Bassam was in prison. He was spending 7 years in prison. He was a Israeli soldiers and Palestinians together. Right? And 2 years after founding Combatants for Peace, his daughter gets a rubber bullet in the back of the head. I mean, who can even imagine that sort of story? Mm. And then he goes around the world after this happens, telling his own story, because he believes that it will somehow profoundly put a tiny crack in the wall, and eventually, with enough cracks and enough leaders and enough talkers, enough, you know, of us engaging with this, it's going to bring the whole thing tumbling down, and there will be dust there, and somebody's got to be able to, you know, stand up and dust themselves off and start something new. That's their whole philosophy behind this.
Has their momentum been mostly in the Middle East, or is their momentum outside? I mean, I know they travel internationally. Is their audience more sympathetic outside of their countries?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, these two guys. So one of them, they're in their 50s and almost 70 now. They go to, say, an Israeli high school. There are protesters outside. And they say, well, we're talking about peace, but nobody wants to even. A lot of people don't want to hear the word peace.
Mm-hmm.
And but they go in and they stand against it. They go to a Palestinian school. They get called collaborators and all sorts of things. It's like it's a very, very, very difficult thing for them to do. But I think the pressure from outside is so much better than the pressure inside. And I think that Rami and Bassam recognize it. Yes, they do a lot of work in the West Bank, and yes, they do a lot of work in Israel itself. But the work that they do in Sweden and the work that they do in Germany and Ireland, and particularly the United States, because Americans are generous people, and you know, they get taken by a story like this, and they will give their $10 to the parent circle, or to Narrative 4, or whoever it happens to be, and in that way, you know, the story lives on. Like Bassam said, when he buried his daughter, he made a pronouncement over her grave and said that your name, Abir, will last longer than the name of your killer, and he's right.
Yeah.
And how is that done? It's done through storytelling. And I think after a roof over your head and food in your belly, one of the primary things that we swerve towards is the act and the art of stories and storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's you know, incredibly important that we get a chance to stand up in there and say, this is what happened to me. We need to shape the world in a different way than what we're shaping it right now, because otherwise we're going to be in trouble.
Well, the story obviously centers on the two of them. You keep coming back to the two of them. Did you have to, at what point research wise did you feel like, because you, as you say and as I say, it's so confusing over there, did you realize you had at least enough of your arms around enough of the stuff that you could tell the story, you know, from a political, historical, religious perspective? Were you doing the research commensurate with writing the book? And when did you feel like, okay, I at least have enough to, yeah, to tell this story?
I was writing and researching at the same time. And I have to say, I was pretty darn terrified at the beginning. And in the beginning, I made like four really sort of long, quick, or long trips to try. And what I do, I just walked around. Mm. I hung out. I talked to people. You know, I went to as many parts of the of the whole landscape as I could. I met with writers. I met with Palestinian singers. I went walking in these bird ringing or bird banding centers, and I read and I read and I read and I read and I read, at a certain time, I can't locate it exactly for you, but there was a certain time when I thought, okay, I can do this, or I have to do this. But even as I was writing, even toward the end of this book, which, you know, I was just finishing, like, last year, even towards the end of this book, I was like, oh, my gosh, what have I done? Well, is this going to be disastrous? Is this going to, you know, have I gotten it all wrong? You know, there was always that right up until the last moment, and then showing it to people. I had to show it. Oh, my gosh. How many reads I got on this thing. You know, I would get simultaneous sort of Palestinian Christian reads and Palestinian Muslim reads, and these two Palestinians would sort of directly contradict each other on notions of fact. And so you have to, like, take all of this into consideration. You have to weigh it all up. And then, in the end, the facts themselves don't actually matter, because facts are mercenary things. You can use them, right? And you can just, like, you know, you can take them wherever you want them to go. They fight whatever little war you want, you know, and they will get paid for it. But texture is a different thing. Texture is about a truth, a human truth, the sort of Faulknerian stuff, where he talks about love and pride and pity and compassion and sacrifice and all those sort of, like, complicated, crazy human things that go on in our heads and our hearts, and so that then was most important to me, that I would get at the you know, the emotional texture, the emotional truth of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other, I guess, device, the subliminal pleasure that the reader got from all these disparate, you know, there'll be a mathematical equation, or there'll be a reference to a song, or how a musical instrument works. And the reverberation of that truth over the less interesting assemblage of facts was really the driving engine under this piece. And I think it was, you're right, the juxtaposition of these subliminal things in our subconscious that gave us this understanding, kind of deeper understanding of what these characters, who can imagine what these characters or what these men have gone through. As you pointed out, either in one of our other interviews or another interview, this idea that I think is worth saying again, that there is no word in English for losing a child, that just doesn't exist. And the kind of the power of that silence, that we can't even name it.
We can't even name it. There is a word in Hebrew, there is a word in Arabic, but in most languages, like French, German, Spanish, there's no noun for you know, we have a widow, we have a widower, we have an orphan, we have all these things, but we don't have a word for a parent who has lost a child. It seems like so impossible that we can't even get our language around it. And that was one of the other things, like, I kept discovering new things. You talk about music, you know, Smadar, who's the young 13-year-old Israeli girl who gets killed. One of her favorite singers was Sinead O'Connor. She even shaved her head and pierced her nose to look a little bit like Sinead O'Connor. This is back in 1997. Then I started, like, thinking, well, maybe, you know, what was her favorite song? Well, it was probably Nothing Compares to You. Then just a couple of months ago, and this is one of these cases where the world just delivers you these incredible surprises. I was watching Irish television, and who gets on the television but Sinead O'Connor wearing a hijab, having become Muslim, right?
What?
Singing in the most extraordinary way, Nothing Compares to You. And I sent it to Rami, who is Smadar's father, and he broke down in tears. It was just like, you know, a conjunction of all these things coming together. And then, of course, Nothing Compares to You was written by Prince, and then you can extrapolate further and further and further out of all this. It, all the time, it keeps coming back to the two girls.
And that's
the most important thing. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. Keep telling their story. And for me, that was the most profound. profound thing about dealing with Rami and Bassam, because these men are graceful. But they're ordinary men too. Yeah, I mean, just yesterday evening, I was at a restaurant with them. This is the kind of weird thing. I was at a restaurant with the two characters from my novel. Rami was getting in the seat and he was taking his jacket off, and Bassam was sitting beside him. And just in the funniest, tenderest, very male way, Bassam helped Rami by tugging the sleeve of the jacket. And I looked at that and I thought, ah, wow, the power of tiny moments. Because I do believe, and a part of what this novel is about, is that we have to be tiny and epic at both at the same time.
Yeah.
And if we can be both of those, then we'll somehow get to that which matters, the music which matters, and the music which lasts.
There's such a tender photograph in the book. The book also has a handful of photographs, and there's such a tender one of Rami and Bassam with when they're riding on a bus or a train, and somebody has their head on the other's shoulder, and I think that don't they make a joke about that at some point, like get your head off,
get your head off my shoulder, They use a famous line from an Israeli skit: "Haven't the Jews suffered enough?"
Haven't the Jews suffered?
And so Bassam has his head on Rami's shoulder, and Rami says to him, "Hey, man, haven't the Jews suffered enough?" That's the other thing about these men. They can be funny and offhand, and it's not all, it's not all doom and gloom. Far from it. What they're trying to do is inspire people. Talk about this stuff. Let's talk about it. Let's get it out there. And anybody who's listening, who's lost, a child, or lost anybody in any way, will understand the story of Rami and Bassam. The parent circle is for the families of what we in English say, the bereaved. And that means cousins, brothers, sisters. Even though it's called parent circle, It really has to do with extended family, and we're all part of that extended family. Whether we come from Ireland or Sweden or Iceland or whatever it happens to be, North Dakota, we're all sort of there in the story of these these youngsters. And once we can acknowledge that, then we can start to change this stuff around, I believe, because there's always going to be movements, and they'll come from young people, I think, in particular.
Mm-hmm.
The ones who are in the high schools now. The ones we work with in Narrative 4, nonprofit story exchange organization that I was talking about, you should see these kids. Oh my gosh, the energy comes from, it's like all the young Greta Thunbergs of the world saying, okay, it's time. Your generation has messed this around. Get out of my way. Let me talk to somebody else. Instead of shutting myself away, staring down into my handheld telephone, let's get out and look at each other, look each other in the eye, and ultimately try to understand somebody else's story.
You guys are going to be here, well, you're going to be here next week, because I'm going Tuesday night, March 10th, I think. I'm not looking at a calendar. At the Skirball Center. Are the men coming with you?
You betcha.
Oh, that's great. Well, even more reason to go if there wasn't already huge amounts of reasons to go. And I know you can get tickets online. I got my ticket a long time ago, so I assume they're still available. But you can look up the Skirball Center. I can't remember. Is it through the Writer's Block program that you're coming? Or I can't remember.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. Great.
And we'll be in San Diego before that, and San Francisco before that, a lot of running around. My carbon imprint, this is what my daughter tells me, my carbon imprint is a problem. So I'm doing I'm doing all sorts of carbon buybacks. Actually, even this afternoon, I'm going to be getting online doing my carbon buybacks. But I believe in this book enough, or I believe in the story of of these two men enough that I'll do carbon buybacks till the cows come home.
Exactly.
As long as other people get to read it and engage with it.
It is, yeah. It's worth all the carbon. This book has such a quality last question of, you know, kids don't try this at home. So in terms of writing it. And whatever you tell your students writing-wise, you know, advice you give, writing wisdom you give, is it more of a do as I say, don't as I, not as I do kind of message or kind of
You know, I've been at my students for a few years to write a novel like this. Or you know, to write a novel that sort of reflects the zeitgeist, the mental zeitgeist, the cultural zeitgeist, I suppose I just said enough that I said, well, if I'm not prepared to do it, why should I be asking them to do it? I sort of jumped off the cliff. You know that famous quote by Kurt Vonnegut? I love it. He said, "We should be continually jumping off of cliffs and developing our wings on the way down."
Right.
It's kind of lovely.
That is lovely. Although so many of the new writers haven't even developed any wings, so it's hard to... you should jump off really low walls maybe at the beginning.
Well, the thing is about writing is that, you know, in that metaphorical sense, you're going to be jumping off a low wall, indeed. You know, you're not... You know, if you fall, smash and burn, you know, you're going to be able to get up again. I do think there will be a new energy come about, you know, in the next few years, a new sort of form of narrative, a new form of engagement. I think fiction is going to get particularly political. I think it's also going to get in your face, you know, say certain things that. It's sort of avoided before. It used to be that, like, you know, a writer's politics was as bad as his greed, you know, and as dangerous as anything else. But now we're in such strange times that maybe it's time for the writer to work out of this incredibly reckless inner need to talk about things that are. You know, important to the pulse of important to the pulse of the moment.
Yeah.
We got a lot of things going on, and also then, as you know, you just want to tell a rattling good story as well.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Right.
It is a form of entertainment in a way. It's not a form of instruction. It is a form of entertainment, but the entertainment doesn't have to make you belly laugh and, you know, all the time. But I think we nod. Once we get those stories that make us say, aha, I knew that, but I didn't know that I knew that, that's the sort of stuff that makes you think, ah, okay, good.
Right. It's time to get a little impolite, maybe, as writers, yeah. To that end, Gish Jen is going to be on next week with the Resistors, so, yeah, amen to doing all that, yeah. Yeah.
Amen and hallelujah to all that. Yes, right. Absolutely.
Right. Colin McCann, this was such a huge pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for giving me the time. And I hope we get to talk a fifth time.
The fourth time, I was going to say. I can't wait for the fifth time now. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And,
thanks so much.
Thank you. This was great.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye-bye.